It is Thursday, July 14th, and we'll get going. We have I would say a light but intense agenda tonight. There's some heavy topics, and I'll just go ahead and turn it right over to Greg.
All right. Thank you, Diana. First, I want to introduce, for those of you who don't know, Leah Johansson. She's an engineer with WEST in our service water program. So thank you and welcome, Leah. I hope everybody had a great 4th of July and are enjoying the summer weather we're finally experiencing. I certainly am. A couple quick things that I may have already mentioned. This first thing that WEST won an award, PNCWA, the Pacific Northwest Clean Water Association, which covers Washington, Idaho, and Oregon, their sustainability award for the work that we did in partnership with PGE and Energy Trust of Oregon on the cogen and solids handling project. So that's great, and we will accept that award in Spokane in August. So looking forward to that. The other thing I wanted to give an update, anybody who's been anywhere near Oregon City lately or on 205 knows that they're going great guns already on the I-205 bridge. And virtually everywhere I go, people are asking me about it. So I thought I'd give an update on where we're at with respect to our projects, of which we have two related to that project. So I asked Jeff Stallard, who's a project manager, to give me an update. We did select a company called Michaels Corporation, which, according to Jeff, is a top tunneling firm in the U.S. to be the design builder. And we're now in final stages of contract negotiation. So you award it, and then you negotiate and ultimately award the contract. So we expect that to happen in the next few weeks. We've gotten DEQ's initial approval of the outfall location in the river. So that's good. And it's where we wanted it to be per the preliminary design. We've applied for permits from U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And that can take up to 18 months, according to Jeff, to process, because there's Department of State Lands and tribal review and DEQ review. And it's a pretty, you know, lengthy and thorough process. So it could take about 18 months. And then as far as our project on the bridge, which is a force main across the bridge, we have signed an agreement with Kiewit to do that work, and we're working closely. So it's just part of the ODOT project. We'll be involved and giving, you know, having correspondence back and forth. But as part of the overall ODOT 205 bridge project, we will walk away with a new force main across the river, which is great because the two force mains that we have that cross the Willamette are under the river and quite old. So it'll be great to have that moving into the future.
What are you going to do with the old ones?
We'll still use them, as far as I know, until we don't. Eventually, they'll probably be abandoned in place, assuming that the regulators will allow us to do that. Kiewit, which is the company that is the contractor for ODOT that's building the bridge, approached us and for staging area. They need their construction trailers and vehicle parking and some material storage. So we agreed to allow them to use about 3 acres on the southern end tip of our property, which was great. We don't need the land right now, and we're going to get about $200,000 in rent or lease money over the course of the next 3 years as they do that project. So a little bit of revenue brought in there. And then according to Jeff, we are expecting the outfall to be brought online in 2025. So that's my update. Any questions about that? All right, thanks.
Okay, we're going to move on to public comment. And as far as I can tell, we don't have anyone that we don't know online. So hearing no public comment, we're going to move right on to the Wes? Oh.
Public comment.
Oh. You're not the public.
Didn't we move these meetings to Thursdays to allow for Commissioner Rocky Smith to join us?
Yes.
And?
And I talked to him at a gathering that we had in Oregon City. He indicated he would make an effort to attend. I got a little bit different take from Greg Geist on that, so I'll let him answer that.
Well, I can't speak for Rocky. Although on another hand, I go to the OC Oregon City Business Alliance luncheons monthly, and I had the privilege of sitting next to Adam Marl, who's also a commissioner for Oregon City. We had a great conversation. He's interested in taking a tour, and you know, I'm going to try to build a bridge to Oregon City any way I can.
Good luck.
Thank you. Thank you for trying. It would be nice to have their representation at this meeting for sure, because I think it's really important to have someone from each city represented, and they're a big one. So if you know anyone, William, that you can talk to.
I know a lot.
If you got an in, do your magic.
I'm for lack of trying.
I know. All right, so we're going to go on to the West Exchange report. This is going to be Aaron and Matt. Matt's going to start, and then it'll be Aaron, and then it's going to be back to Matt. So this is going to – we got to keep up.
Hello, everybody. I feel so honored to be able to kick the evening off with presentations. Just want to thank you all for taking time out of your evenings, the gorgeous summer weather that we're finally having to learn some more about initiatives and projects that are going on in our organization. So thank you for that. To start, let's talk about the why behind the West Exchange. The West Exchange is one of the initial steps that we've taken to support our Performance Clackamas strategic business plan update. Performance Clackamas is a strategic plan that's modeled after a process known as managing for results, which has been successfully used in cities and counties throughout the United States. Clackamas County departments and West have been using this model since 2015, with several light touch updates every few years. This year, we are working on a more robust plan refresh, and the West Exchange builds on the success of the Clean Water Exchange and recent employee engagement surveys soliciting input to better understand opportunities and strategic actions for improvements. We want this strategic business plan update to better resonate with our customers, our staff, and connect with our clean water utility roots. As you learn more about the West Exchange and the highlights from this process, you're going to see a number of similar themes from our staff, which further reinforces the important work that we all have ahead of us. Next slide, please.
I just realized you said management for results. I thought you had said management for revolt.
Nope, for results. We're all about the results.
Great.
So before I review the agenda, I want to thank our project team. Our lead, Shelley, as Diana mentioned, apologizes that she was unable to be with us tonight. I think she'd like to be presenting this, but she's off fishing for halibut in Alaska. That sounds like fun and actually a lot of work. Done that a few times. So that's pretty cool for her. But our other team members, Lauren Haney, who's with us tonight, Aaron Blue, who will be helping me with this, and then Akiko Gates. And I'm obviously a part of the team too. As for the agenda, this evening we're going to review the West Exchange purpose, share highlights from what we learned, identify areas of similar discoveries between the Clean Water Exchange and the West Exchange, review how we translated the input and discoveries into a new vision, mission, and set of core values, which we'll be seeking approval for during the Performance Clackamas process, and walk you through the West Exchange steps from discovery to action through the Performance Clackamas refresh. And now I'm going to pass it to Aaron, to walk us through the process.
Thanks, Matt. So keeping the background that Matt just shared in mind, the purpose of the West Exchange was to help West enhance communication and foster stronger organizational alignment and create clarity around our vision, mission, and values, which are brought to life in our performance Clackamas plan and in the work that we do every day. As has been shared in Greg and Shelley's recent messages, it will also help West chart a course for building a more resilient future for our organization, each other, and our customers. Next slide, please. Before we share what we learned, I'd like to quickly go over the steps that we took to get where we are today. As you can see, the West Exchange followed a similar multidimensional methodology to that used in the Clean Water Exchange, but from an internal focus rather than an external stakeholder focus. To start, in the fall, we facilitated group interviews with members of the management team to assess the Performance Clackamas process and our current strategic plan. Those early group interviews resembled a traditional SWOT analysis, where we examined West's strengths, opportunities, weaknesses, and threats through the lens of Performance Clackamas. The feedback from the group interviews was then carried forward to the leadership team, who helped us chart a course for the all-staff online survey and virtual focus groups. Each of the engagement methods built on the previous and reinforced the feedback that we heard from the earlier steps. As we report out on the online survey in the coming slides, you'll likely notice some parallels between the data that we learned in the Clean Water Exchange as it relates to both future concerns and aspirations. We'll also be providing context into similarities between the West Exchange survey results and what we've recently learned from the two county employee engagement surveys. Next slide, please. So the West Exchange online survey consisted of 13 questions and combined a mix of primarily open-ended questions with some multiple choice questions and a matrix rate question. Those were all designed to solicit input from staff on West's vision, mission, and priorities, as well as to check on emerging obstacles. Out of our roughly 100 employees, 63 participated in the survey and represented all four of West's divisions. The word cloud on this slide shows the words most used in response to the open-ended question that asked how staff would describe West's role in the community. The bigger and bolder the word on this slide, the more often it was used. Not surprisingly, clean water, environmental protection, and public health rose to the top. And interestingly, these results align really closely with the values external stakeholders identified as the top priorities in the Clean Water Exchange, where clean waters in rivers and streams was the highest rated value, followed closely by habitat and public health. This was a mission-related question, and that alignment lets you know that internally we see our role in the community the same way that our customers, community partners, and external stakeholders see us. Next slide, please. This next question was aimed at revealing shared aspects of West's vision. When asked to finish the sentence, "At West, we want to be known for and as," participants responded with variations on clean water champions, connected to the community, customer experience leaders, defenders of public health, protectors of waterways. And again, you can see the bolded words here rose to the top as the most frequently used. The emphasis on community in response to this question reflected some of the same feedback, again, that was shared in the Clean Water Exchange, where external stakeholders recognize the importance of future opportunities for us to expand and strengthen our connections through additional partnerships, outreach, and education. And again, these responses were valuable in demonstrating that we have strong alignment in both internal and external feedback. Next slide, please. Mission statements should describe the for whom, what, and why of the work we do. And a good goal would be to have a mission statement that's 90% of the way there in terms of articulating what we do and why we do it. And as you can see from this slide, when we asked for direct feedback on the effectiveness of the mission statement from West's staff, we learned that about 70% felt that it was doing okay, but that there was definitely room for improvement. Specific concerns were voiced that resource recovery and watershed protection are industry terminology and jargon, and that those terms don't accurately reflect the work that we do or that how staff view their work. And in fact, a lot of the feedback that we received on this question revealed that not only did staff not clearly understand the terms themselves, they were also really concerned that our customers wouldn't understand them. And while it's important for staff to see themselves in the work we do in the mission statement, even more important, they felt that customers needed to understand the work that we do as well. Recommendations for revising West's mission statement included incorporating language that better describes what we do, who we are, and who we do it for. And a lot of these are the same themes from earlier survey questions, including environmental protectors, clean water champions, community advocates and educators. Next slide, please. Both of the recent employee surveys ranked organizational vision as low, so we already had some pretty good evidence that one of the areas we needed to address was lack of connection to Wes's vision statement. Vision statements should be all the things that you see on this slide. They should be forward-looking, aspirational, motivational, memorable. So the Wes Exchange survey asked if the vision statement was hitting those marks, and the results gave us an understanding of why it wasn't resonating with staff on the two employee engagement surveys. As you recall, we saw community as the standout response to the earlier question about what we want Wes to be known for. And the most reinforced theme was that a collaborative sentiment is exactly what's missing from this vision statement. Other themes that emerged included an unclear understanding of the word premier and a lack of connection to the value of being known, regionally known. Recommendations that we learned were to incorporate language that describes the commitment that we're working towards, including excellent customer service, resilient infrastructure, public health and well-being, environmental protection, and fiscal responsibility and economic vitality. Next slide, please. When asked to identify and rank obstacles to reaching Wes's vision, similar to what we learned in the Clean Water Exchange, staff reflected enhanced customer service, infrastructure improvements, workforce development, and community partnerships were the most important actions we could take. Environmental concerns and climate change also ranked highly on both the external and internal surveys. Workforce development and staffing shortages had again been identified in the two employee engagement surveys as areas we needed to focus on, so we weren't surprised to see those results reinforced here as well. Next slide, please. In summary, and as you can see from these takeaways, Wes staff highly valued teamwork, stakeholder partnerships, and customer service. We take our charge as clean water champions seriously, and we're proud of the work that we do to protect public health and environment. The survey also revealed that we had opportunities to improve. We need to focus on issues of workforce development, strengthening relationships and communication, and ensuring that the mission and vision resonate with staff. Next slide, please. So, what did we do with all that good data? Well, thanks to Greg Geist and the leadership team, we were able to work with staff to reimagine our vision, mission, and set of core values that reflect the feedback received and better represent who we are, what we do, and why we matter to the people that we serve. In the spring, we hosted 6 focus groups to gather additional input. At the completion of the focus groups, the leadership team met and used the combined input to create a new vision, mission, and affirm a set of core values that will serve as the foundational elements of the refreshed Performance Clackamas strategic plan. Next slide, please. This is our new vision, and I hope that you can see how the input from both processes led us to this new statement, as well as the new mission statement that will be shared on the next slide. And one of my favorite quotes from the Clean Water Exchange was just simply, "Let's do more together." And that sentiment was reinforced in so many ways throughout both processes, and that's essentially where we landed with this new vision statement. At Wes, our vision is to be a collaborative partner in building a resilient clean water future where all people benefit and rivers thrive. This new vision captures the collaborative aspect that was missing from the earlier version. It defines success as forward-looking and motivational. Next slide, please. The new mission statement eliminates the jargon to improve clarity and brings in the themes from our work that staff most strongly identified with so that everyone can see themselves in the statement. And what's also key, our customers and stakeholders can now understand the importance of the work that we do. This new mission captures our role as environmental protectors, clean water champions, wastewater, sewer, and stormwater service providers, community advocates and educators, and defenders of public health. Next slide, please. Another outcome of the Wes Exchange was a reaffirmation of Wes's core values, which is been undergoing some fine-tuning since the rebranding process a couple of years ago. And the input from staff in the Wes Exchange led to the addition of the value investment in our people. The other 5 had already been established. These core values affirm what we stand for, and it also gives us an opportunity to elaborate on the themes in Wes's vision and mission. Next slide, please. And in addition to the development of those foundational strategic planning elements, we were able to identify some short-term actions to take based on feedback to build trust. We're currently working on implementing ideas in these focus areas to address obstacles identified in the Wes Exchange relating to staffing, operations, and communication from management. The short-term wins that we get here will help us bridge the gap while we work on the next steps in the strategic plan refresh. And I will hand it back to Matt to talk about additional recommendations and what's next.
Thank you, Erin. So, roadmap for continued communications, where are we headed? Similar to the Clean Water Exchange, the West Exchange team recommends creating a communication roadmap to keep staff and stakeholders engaged and connected to the strategic planning process and beyond. The approach will include periodic reports, milestone celebrations, team conversations, and more. It's further recommended that a core team be identified to help navigate the journey and keep the engagement connections with all of you and with our staff strong. Next slide, please. We are currently in the strategic plan development phase of our performance Clackamas strategic plan update. You can see that in the flowchart above. We've been going through a cycle of assessment and adjustment every several years, as I mentioned earlier. This year's plan refresh will be more significant, and we want to ensure it connects with our staff and our customers and provide strategic focus where we need to grow. And I'll talk later on this evening about some of the foundational work that my team, the asset management team, has been working on to support data insights into our operations and business that will augment our measurement and analysis abilities as we move forward with this process. Next slide, please. So, next steps with our process. This summer into fall, the West management team will undertake a deeper dive into a strategic priorities look that will guide West over the next planning cycle. These priorities will be further developed and incorporated into West's Performance Clackamas strategic business plan using best practices from the EPA Effective Utility Management Framework, something I'm excited to learn more about. It's a framework designed to help water and wastewater utility managers make informed decisions and practical systematic changes to achieve excellence in utility performance, all about the continuous improvement cycle. This work will inform our plan that will provide strategic direction, outline measurable goals, and identify key performance indicators. We'll be building lots of reports for those. It will be important that the West management team find creative ways to ensure the plan is valued and useful to all as it relates to guiding day-to-day decisions, evaluating progress, making changes moving forward. The revised Performance Clackamas plan will be submitted for county administration corporate review in early 2023. We plan to have our plan completed, written, submitted by the end of this year, as you can see above. We're confident that by engaging all staff and stakeholders in this process and throughout the journey, this will improve our ability to be the best utility that we can be and provide a brighter clean water future for all. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Great presentation, Matt and Erin. Shelley would be very proud. did anyone have any questions on this?
Oh, if you don't mind, I'd like to just chime in. So this was a product really of, you know, actually 2 years of employee engagement survey work that was done, not just within West, but across the county. And also looking forward to this Performance Clackamas, our strategic plan update. And one of the things that's common to both is this mission and vision. And so we're really trying to take what we learned and align our mission and vision to something that resonates with people and that they can see themselves in. So I think, you know, we're not immune, to, you know, the macroeconomics that are going on and the workforce upheaval. I feel like we've gotten a little bit ahead of it by starting this process when we did, and this focus on workforce development and having staff recognize and align with the mission and vision, I think will help us through this time. So I'm just thankful for this work and, happy to take any questions.
Greg?
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much as a question, but an observation, and it goes back to experience I've had certainly with employees in the past. I like what you've done, and I don't disagree with any of it. I look at your mission statement, and I don't disagree with that. The issue, observation, and a comment to you is one of the things I've always felt mission statements ought to do is everybody in the organization ought to know it. And if I go up to an employee and I say, what's your mission statement? 9 out of 10 times, they don't know it. And they'll go, well, you know, we're about making clean water, or we're about treating wastewater, or whatever, but they don't really know it. And so my experience always was to keep my mission statement short, but to the point, so that every employee would know it. I could go, and they'd know what the mission is. And I think the first sentence of your mission statement does that. And I think every employee could know that. But they certainly aren't going to know we do this by so forth and so on, which isn't really the mission statement. It's just how you accomplish it. Your true mission statement, I think, is that first sentence. And I think, frankly, just my observation is that's all I'd have, frankly, because it tells every employee could know what that is, what we're about as an organization, and what we're trying to do, which goes back to all the work you folks did, talking to everybody and getting what you do. Anyway, it's just an observation that, based on my experience anyway, that I just wanted to share with you.
You know, Greg, that's an excellent observation. And at the end of the day, if I can get West employees to be able to recite that first sentence, that would be perfect. One thing that I don't know that we've, I don't think we've mentioned. So the performance Clackamas process, there is an expectation, I guess, around the mission and vision, or the vision and mission statements, and they have to do certain things. And so we were kind of balancing that quick hit with what we're ultimately going to need to get approved when we update our long-term or our strategic plan, which is a county-wide endeavor. And so we're kind of trying to thread the needle a little bit in making sure that we can meet those expectations and having something, you know, that resonates and is fairly pithy with our employees.
Thank you.
Okay. Great comment. Anyone else? I don't think I've been involved in an organization before that has self-reflects as often as West does, and, you know, is oftentimes almost critical of what you guys do yourselves and trying to make things better. And I think that's, you know, bravo to you for looking forward and trying to always grow. And I don't know. I just think it's very kind of unusual, I think, but that's just my point of view. If there's no other comments or questions, I'm going to move on to Ron. Ron is giving us the next installment of the Storm System Master Plan.
Yeah. Are we ready? That's good. And again, another thanks to Matt and Aaron, you know, when Shelley, like Matt said, she unfortunately couldn't be here for that presentation, and she said she couldn't be here. We thought, you know, Greg or I are going to give that presentation, and we, you know, we kind of said no. There's Matt and Aaron, part of the team, along with Lauren, are the best people to give it, and they really stepped up and took charge of that. So I really appreciate that. And so that work, you know, I think again, what really resonates in our vision for the future is how we work with our communities and in terms of making their plans come to fruition as well, and really focus on, in large part, the livability of our community, especially when it comes to public health and the environment. And so, yeah, that should be reflected in everything that we do, and it certainly is in our storm system master planning effort. We gave an update in May. It was sort of the introduction to the plan. I covered, why we're doing the plan, goals, our approach, explain a little bit how the storm system is different than our wastewater or sanitary system, and the planning is a little different as well. We'll revisit some of that, and then touch a little bit on the structure of the plan as well. And so we're gonna dive a little bit deeper into that tonight, more about the programmatic elements where projects live, as well as the capital improvement projects list for the larger, more significant projects that are shaping up in the plan, and also provide some cost estimates that, you know, pretty rough based on concepts for the CIP and those buckets those other programmatic buckets on what that might look like over a couple of planning horizons, whether we approach this somewhat ambitiously or over a longer term. So I hope to get through that tonight and create some opportunity for discussion when we'll touch on at the end the next steps. But just keep in mind, we intend to come back in September with the third installment and talk more about costs, capital budgets and potential rate impacts or rate proposals to make this work happen. So that's what we're going to do. Next slide, please. I can't see people's hands, so I'm relying on Diana as usual just to stop me if somebody has a question along the way. So just to revisit the goals again, this is I think we said this recently when I was talking to Greg. This plan is a long time coming. The WES has not had an approved or adopted storm system master plan since we started managing surface water, since those responsibilities were given to the districts. There have been planning efforts over time. There was a master plan developed in 2005 that wasn't adopted, and then there were sort of a shift in approach in around 2009 and 10, where WES took a watershed management approach and developed watershed action plans for the Kellogg Mount Scott watersheds and for Rock Creek. This is an opportunity as those sort of sunset to get back to our roots when it comes to being a stormwater utility and getting a plan in place to help guide the decisions that we make about what we're building and when, where, and why. So we are certainly excited about it, and we're getting really close. Our goals, again, are just to document what a lot of the work that we know needs to be done throughout our system. Again, our storm systems are not closed systems. It's not toilet to treatment plant. They're not closed systems like drinking water systems. They're decentralized. They're distributed throughout our communities. And in large part, and it's the direction we're going in the future, is to collect and treat and discharge stormwater as quickly as possible to receiving waters and not convey it for long distances. So the approach to trying to identify improvements to the storm system itself is really kind of a project-based approach. It allows us to document the issues that we know that we have, to create a framework to manage those issues and get them addressed. Again, to give us that CIP that we haven't had, that capital improvement plan and that projects list. A big part of our goal was to serve Happy Valley's needs in their comprehensive planning effort for Pleasant Valley and North Carver. And we did that. We touched on that last time, the regional facilities concepts. And then again, to advance some policies to guide decision-making when it comes to managing our storm system. So there are elements of the plan that talk about how to do regional facilities, how to partner better with our transportation agencies to make sure we know what each other are doing, and we're capitalizing on opportunities to work on things together, because our storm systems are closely tied to roads. So that's what we're after. Next slide, please. Our process, again, we sort of just, shook the trees and gathered up all the fruit. It was reviewing all of our existing studies, reports, databases, our asset management system that identified chronic drainage issues, previous projects that had been designed at some point and put on the shelf. It was really gathering what we knew. And then a lot of meetings with our consultant OTAC, with our staff and our partners at the county and city of Happy Valley to identify issues that they knew about. We created a GIS database of all of these issues. And again, I think I said this last time, there were well over 100 issues that were distilled down into 106 distinct projects that were then distributed in the framework of the plan. In order for, at least on the CIP side, to be able to rate and rank projects to give us some sort of priority, we created a sort of our values, our scoring criteria and our priorities, which can change. The priorities do change over time, and I'll touch on those when we start talking about the CIP. So the visioning piece, and then solutions, again, the grouping of projects and opportunities into places that we can manage them, the creation of the capital projects list, and then developing concepts for those projects and costs so we can start talking about budget and things like that. Next slide. So the programs, you know, I presented this last time. There are six programs in the Storm System Master Plan framework. The top five programs, which we'll touch on, are more programmatic in nature in that they're not necessarily a list of projects. They are buckets, we call them, as types of projects that we can deliver over time. They're generally smaller in nature. They can be bundled and require less design work. And they're relatively small construction projects, some of which we can do ourselves if we have staffing availability. But Leah and I work on a lot of small bids to do projects like that. They, important and meaningful and impactful projects don't always come in big packages. Sometimes they're relatively small, and that's what these programmatic elements address. And this is the picture on the slide is an example of a small project like that where we have a storm system that is not efficiently capturing and conveying water in Happy Valley. It was flowing through people's yards and damaging yards and homes. And we were able to do a small conveyance project to more efficiently capture that water and put it where it's supposed to go. That's a lot of what these little projects are. The sixth element is the priority CIP, and that's the projects list. So these all work together to house the issues that we know we need to address. Next slide. So let's talk about what these are a little bit. You know, all detention ponds, when they're built, they're intended to control water, provide some treatment, slowly meter water out over time. We see them throughout our community. They need ongoing programmatic maintenance every year. And then every once in a while, they kind of need a reboot. They need to have a significant amount of vegetation and accumulated sediment and some repair work on structures and things like that all need to be done. When that needs to be done just sort of depends on how we've treated them over the years, how well we've maintained them, and how much sediment and other pollution they've received. It could be 10 years, 15, 20 or so, 20 years after they are first constructed, but at some point they're going to need significant work. We've done some condition assessments on detention ponds that Wes has either operational responsibility or owns. And we know that on that list, there are 300 to 400, I think, detention ponds on that list. And roughly 50 to 60 of those ponds are currently in need of rehabilitation. So those were sort of a consistent theme in the project opportunities and went into this particular program. Next slide. Water quality retrofits. This is something that we're actually mandated to do through our municipal stormwater permit, and also to some degree loosely with our pollution reduction plans for total maximum daily load or water cleanup plans that are issued by DEQ for particular water bodies, where we have benchmarks to improve water quality over time. It's not just about keeping water quality from degrading or holding where we are. We're actually expected and required by the Clean Water Act to improve water quality over time. And so while there's not a set amount of projects that you do need to do or a certain amount of area you need to treat, there is a requirement to have a retrofit program where we add water quality treatment capacity to the storm system. We try and identify opportunities to, as I said before, partner with road projects and things like that in older areas that were developed and prior to the Clean Water Act or prior to current water quality design standards and add water quality as we go. This will be an ongoing thing as we manage surface water in our community. Right now there are, you know, about 9 projects on the list, and they can be relatively small in nature. This was Nellaway was a project that Leah did where we actually had a conveyance issue that was where water was on the surface coming out of the storm system, damaging property. And when we went in and rebuilt that system, we added a small hydrodynamic separator to provide some water quality treatment while we were in there. So stuff like that. Next slide. Small drainage projects. We have a lot of these. These are again, where water is either not going where we want it to go or is not doing what we want it to do. And, you know, these projects really consist of of modifying, adding inlets to the street system along curves where we're not collecting water efficiently, doing pipe repairs where we have either pipe damage or things like that. We're doing a project like that, but Leah just bid one where we have some root damage and root intrusion that has actually damaged a pipe that we have to replace along the Scott Creek Trail in Happy Valley. So we have to dig up the pipe and replace it. Sometimes we line it. If we do root removal and we can line the project, we'll certainly line the pipe. We'll do that. We've done a bunch of those projects over time. And so there's a few dozen of those to address. Some we sort of prioritize those by the extent of damage that they're causing. If it's nuisance flooding, it goes a little further down on the list because, you know, we can't do them all at once. This was a project. These are pictures of a project where by design, the stormwater conveyance was supposed to go on the surface through this green space area of this neighborhood, and it was causing significant erosion. The too much flow or the amount of flow that was designed to go there just was eroding the property, and so we went in and stabilized that channel so it wouldn't threaten anyone's yards or structures. Next slide. Restoration and property acquisition. These are projects that, by nature are habitat improvement projects like we've done at Rock Creek. The picture is shown here, the lower portion of Rock Creek where we did channel and bank restoration and riparian planting to stabilize the lower portion of Rock Creek, which, you know, the upper portion being largely in Happy Valley, well, pretty much all in Happy Valley now, is experiencing some changes in hydrology due to development, and so we're trying to get ahead of that in some areas. These projects can also include things like culvert replacements and repair. A lot of times, replacing a culvert that is not sized to the flows or not sized to move sediment through the basin, which is really important for stream health. Replacing those with more appropriately sized culverts can eliminate backwatering, flooding, as well as restore natural function to that stream so that we're not fighting Mother Nature. So that the projects like that can fall into this category. And there were quite a few opportunities that we identified where some of this work might need to be done. Next slide. A UIC is an underground injection control. It's essentially a dry well or some other closed infiltration system defined by law. We have a separate permit to manage our underground injection control devices issued by Department of Environmental Quality in Oregon, and we have obligations under that permit to at times do assessments to look for these systems that might threaten groundwater. And so if they're in the groundwater or they're areas that are really intensely developed and have potentially high pollution sources and don't have enough treatment, things like that, there's a framework within our permit issued to us where we routinely do these assessments. We're doing one now, and we identified dry wells or underground injection control devices that might need to be modified. So again, this is a regulatory obligation per a permit that's issued to us. There are 200 to 300 underground injection control devices that we in Clackamas County have responsibility for. About 10 on this list in this bucket. Next slide. So the last piece is the capital projects list. Again, these are more significant in nature and certainly more complicated, not as straightforward as. Well, I mean, I think Leah would tell you that a lot of the drainage fixes we do are not straightforward. Some are, and those are, you know, nice to do. But sometimes things are pretty complicated, especially if we start dealing with combinations of factors causing a problem, flooding, as well as water quality, a conveyance system issue that is compounded by flooding and the like. These larger projects, I think there were about, you know, just over 30 larger projects identified on the list that then we needed to get down to a smaller list for us to tackle in the near future. Our values are really, when it comes to managing our storm system and projects like this, are shown on the slide on the right. You know, we want to reduce flooding and reduce damage to property caused by the storm system, identify significant maintenance needs and where we have challenging maintenance situations. We need to, and it's a mission of ours to improve water quality and improve stream health through habitat restoration projects, like we said, stream restoration. And then other values are providing projects that offer multiple benefits, whether it's pathways and ways that our communities can enjoy our open spaces, recreation, things like that. And the last one is ease of implementation. We really want to focus on things that we know we can do and are capable of. Those are our overarching values. Every time your priorities might change. You know, we might be more focused on water quality than we are focused on other things, regulatory mandates. You know, if we're issued a new permit that requires us to have more of a focus on water quality improvement, our priorities might change when it comes to analyzing our capital projects list. But in the current work that we did with our city partners and internally, the priorities that came out right now are flooding and maintenance responsibilities. Those are the two drivers of our needs to do projects. And so they are weighted more heavily in the scoring system when we look at projects. The next two are water quality and stream health in terms of weighting. And then at least right now, you know, while still important projects that provide multiple benefits in ease of implementation are weighted the lowest when it comes to looking at our list. So this was the framework that we used to identify our projects for our CIP. Next slide. And this is where they are. These are the 10 projects that made their way onto our capital improvement projects list. You'll notice there are these numbers on here do represent how they ranked in their position on the list. And you'll notice some of the numbers are higher than 10. There is still a bit of subjectivity when it comes to selecting projects, the projects we're going to tackle first. I mean, obviously, we need to at least analyze the projects that are on the list and get to them at some point. But there were, for various reasons, other projects were selected in advance. That's all laid out in the plan. I can touch on a few. One, the highest ranked project was Three Creeks. The project we're doing now where Mount Scott and Dean Creek and Phillips Creek all come together near Milwaukee. And we've talked to the advisory committee a little bit about our Three Creeks floodplain restoration project, but that was number one on the list. And that's, we're already doing that. We don't need to identify that as a project. We started that project a couple years ago when we had the opportunity for a state revolving fund sponsorship loan for design. And so we started that. Another project, the third ranked project is Valley View Drive, I think it is, in Happy Valley. And we started that one in partnership with DTD. That's a conveyance and drainage project that will require some significant installation of the storm system. So one and three were already in play. Those you don't see on the list. The other ones were an effort to sort of balance project types. There were quite a few culvert replacements and stream restoration projects that were in the top 10, and we wanted to have more of a balance of storm system work right now. So pulled projects up that were in the top 15, not in the top 10, but pulled those up. And then also there was some grouping. You'll see a cluster just to draw your attention to the lower left portion. This is our North Clackamas service area. And the five dots that are down there are all on Upper Kellogg Creek. And we know Upper Kellogg Creek has quite a few issues when it comes to how the creek behaves, I guess, for lack of a better term. The dynamics, the balance of the movement of water and sediment is totally out of balance in the upper watershed, and it is impacting how the storm system works. So we have known issues in that area. Three of the projects in that area were on the top 10, and then there were two others that weren't too far down the list. And we made a choice to, at least a recommendation, to have Upper Kellogg Creek be a focal point of this plan and pull those projects up because they are interrelated. Like I said before, a lot of this is decentralized and dispersed throughout our community, but sometimes, you know, it is a network. And when we had a bunch of projects that were all highly related. So when we tackle those, we very likely will tackle them together. So that was a little bit of the art of coming up with the top 10 projects on the list, the recommended projects anyway. Next slide. Thank you, Lauren. So this is the list of the projects. There's sort of a balance here of projects that address drainage needs, like the Valley View Road drainage project that I mentioned, some ditch inlets and installation of flow control where it's causing issues. There are quite a few stream and restoration projects on here, and that has a lot to do with their potential impact on reducing flooding, and particularly where it's impacting function of our storm system. There's a project that is a few down. It's called the NCRA. That's the North Clackamas Revitalization Area. That's a focal area for Clackamas County transportation as well as a development agency. And there was a project that was floating around to install some storm systems where there aren't currently storm systems. So storm system installation, and that one ranked pretty highly as well. So it's a pretty diverse mix of projects on this list that outside of Three Creeks, which scored very high because it touched on all the values and the priorities for us right now, the rest are all kind of grouped in the middle and provide us some flexibility in terms of getting them done. These won't necessarily be tackled in this order as we start to implement the plan when it's adopted. Opportunity drives a lot of what we do in timing and partnerships. And so, but this will be the focus of our work, at least for the next 10 years. The costs are shown on the right. Again, these are costs based on concept only at this point with some contingency, but we have almost $22 million worth of work identified in this projects list. Next slide, please. This is just an example of something you'll see in the plan. I know you probably can't read it, but for each of the projects in the list on the capital, on the CIP list, we developed a fact sheet, and it includes more detailed information about the problem we're trying to solve and the solution we think we would apply. It details the cost estimate, again, at the concept level that we can tie back to. And then the drawing on the right is a concept, just a concept design of what we think the solution might be. The cool thing about our approach with our consultant OTAC on this is they developed a toolkit of practices that we can apply to different types of projects. So when we identify a project in the future and we categorize it, there will be connections back in the framework that the plan provides that'll say, here are some potential remedies that we can then use to create concepts in the future that'll help us plan. These will be in the plan that we're going to get to you to review shortly. Next slide. And then this is what, you know, we showed the cost for the priority capital projects, the CIP. We are also able to estimate costs based on the projects that are also in those other programmatic elements. Now we do have a backlog of projects that over time has been building up as we're trying to provide a framework to deliver projects. We have done quite a bit of work over time, and especially the last 5 or 6 years that Leah and I have been working together. I'll note that Leah and I are the surface water capital program for WES. Thankfully, Leah is highly capable and efficient, so we can get a lot of work done. But each of these projects have a bunch of projects in them right now. And so there's a bit of a backlog over time in the next 10 years. Like if we go 10 years, these will continue. This will continue to be our framework going forward. It's just that these will likely have a smaller amount of work to do, hopefully, if the system continues to function. But we're looking at this over a couple of timeframes. Between now and September, we'll get into, and mainly in September, we'll have a level of service conversation. We'll talk about how we can modify the amounts of funding that we might budget for in these particular programs. We can talk about time frame of delivering this body of work and these projects. It allows us, there's a lot we can do to sort of create alternatives for not only total cost but also rate impacts. We wanted to show here was give you some idea of what we're looking at, because it's, I think when we talk to people about this plan and these projects, they're like, oh yeah, it looks great, you know, let's go do that. But you got to know roughly what we're talking about when it comes to cost. The most ambitious approach that we would have would be, doing this work over a 10-year period. That's dealing with the buckets and the smaller projects, as well as delivering the projects in the list. And this slide shows the annual costs that we would be shooting for in order to meet this work in a 10-year time frame would be about $3.8 million a year. We're spending money now, so that's not all a new spend. We have been doing projects for the past several years, sort of projects of opportunity where we have them, and we've also been transferring our annual revenue from our rates to our capital fund, building a fund balance. So it's all, this isn't a complete add-on, and we'll talk more about that in September. The other thing to note is in as part of our plan as well, there's a formula for staffing to deliver the plan. We do recognize that we have one senior civil engineer with Leah dedicated to managing surface water projects, and this is too much work to do with one FTE. So the recommendation is between two and three, I would say, for the two timeframes looking to deliver this body of work. But increased staffing is certainly something that we'll need to look at. Aaron is working closely with us on our rate modeling right now as the plan takes shape and we know what these dollars, what these estimates are a little bit more solidly than she is able to work to help create some scenarios and give us an idea of what we might be looking at in rate increases over time. Well, that's going to be the bulk of the conversation next time we meet, is what does this all mean? But I think it is good news that we're potentially looking at around 7%, maybe 8% annually over 10 years, which is well within the guidelines of our current financial policies for rate increases. So it's manageable. I mean, we're not committing to that at this point or saying that's what it's going to be, but we at least wanted to have some idea to say, it is what we're proposing wildly unrealistic, and it's really not. So that's good news.
Hey, Ron, can I chime in on that?
Sure.
So 7% year over year rate increases seem, I can see where people would, that would give them pause. I would say that even with that, we're currently well within the bottom third of our peers as far as our surface water rates. And emerging from that, we would continue to be one of, if not the lowest cost surface water rate funded utilities in the region.
Yeah, we'll talk more about the proposal next time, but that would be, you know, for a period of time to build the annual funding to be able to deliver a program like this, and so that's got an end date on it when it comes to funding our capital plan. It isn't in perpetuity just to keep the capital work going. We always have the operational side, and we talk about that every year when we talk about our budget. But it is you know, attainable if we choose to head down that path. So that's good news. And again, I should also say that because we talked touching on rates, you know, this all applies to where people pay our surface water rates. And so, you know, we have different services in different portions of our service district. And so for Oregon City, Westland and Gladstone, Milwaukee, those our rates don't come from those cities on the surface water side of the house, or Johnson City either. Those communities don't pay our surface water fees. So this work is all in our service area for surface water. Next slide, please, Lauren. So that's as far as we wanted to get tonight. A presentation of the framework of the plan, kind of how it's taking shape, a presentation of of the CIP list and where those projects are, including our focus on Upper Kellogg Creek is a significant part of the proposal. A peek at what that might do from a cost and a rate perspective. And then a promise that we will be back in September to make another presentation and seek your recommendation on taking this forward to our commissioners so we can have our first ever adopted surface water storm system master plan. Leah and I are reviewing the draft plan right now. We're probably at about 75%. We're going to get our comments back to our contractor, and I think we will be able to get a draft plan to the advisory committee weeks in advance of the next meeting. We're not going to deliver it with the packet. I'll deliver the draft plan early so people can read it in advance of the September presentation. That's the next step. And that's all I have. Questions?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah, Brian.
So last month or the last meeting, I asked if the culvert under Thiessen Road was a 6-foot circular pipe.
Yeah.
Is it or not?
Well, and that was a good question. And I'm glad you asked. Leah, we have confirmed that Leah can tell you what it is, because I know she not only talked to DTD about it and we have pictures of it, but we have confirmed what it actually is. It may not be, I think you might be right, because I haven't looked at the fact sheet. It might not be right on the fact sheet, and we can edit that because it's a draft plan, but it is right in the modeling that was done that showed that it backwaters at certain flows.
Yeah, because I think it's a 10 or a 12 by 5 box culvert.
I know it's not a box culvert, at least according to the pictures that we have of the culvert. Leah, do you know the exact dimensions? I know you were talking to Joel Howie.
Yeah, I talked to DTD and they actually don't know the exact dimensions of it, but it's an arch culvert. And then there's a smaller pipe that also connects into that arched culvert. But what OTAC has said is, yeah, what we have in the model is correct, and it backwaters regardless of if it's 6 feet or 60 inches. It's still, it has issues.
Well, but so my question is for years we've asked to have the 3 feet of sediment taken out of the bottom of that pipe. So in my logic, in a business world, why would you not back out all the 3 foot of sediment in a 6 foot pipe to get more volume before you spend $900,000.
Well, for one, like Leah said, it's an arch culvert, and so it's that factors into it. And two, we would have to do that every year because the stream is going to put the sediment back into that culvert every year. That's part of what I talked about before in restoring balance, that our streams are modified. And Upper Kellogg Creek in particular has a road or driveway crossing density that is extremely high. And so we have an inability to convey the amount of water and the amount of sediment being delivered to the channel. Even today, actively, we still have eroding slopes that are moving sediment through the system, and the creek will continue to put sediment where it wants to put sediment, which is in the bottom of that road culvert. So we're trying to, rather than do that every year and get into the creek every year, and we would have to do that at other culverts too, Brian, and that you brought to our attention, if we can get the water moving through that portion of the creek, it won't end up there. It's the more sustainable solution.
Well,
and it happens to turn out that DTD is looking to repair that culvert right now anyway. They have a project that they're looking at because the culvert is damaged and it's in training some of the roadway, fill, and it's settling. And so they're currently looking at a project to repair it. And so we're talking to them about replacement rather than repair, project of opportunity.
Well, because most of the sediment that's in that pipe is road gravel. It's not bank sediment. It's pavement. It's road sediment. When you have a road at a 45 degree angle and it pours down rain, the shoulder rock and the pavement wash into that pipe. That's the part I just don't understand. And if you have a situation where you cannot solve the drainage problem, why are you putting new subdivisions in on that system? And then everybody just puts their hands up. I don't get it.
I think you're right in that quite a bit of the material, there is material in there from the roadway. You can see it. DTD has pictures of it. They think it's coming from the rupture in the culvert and that it's bed material given the settling that they're seeing. Yeah, and we can look at that when we do that project and we replace the culvert, if there's ways to do some source control and keep road gravel from washing over the banks into the creek, great. I mean, that would be good too.
Well, you need downturns in your catch bases. There's another thing I don't understand. You don't have downturns, so every piece of gravel in a high velocity water, every piece of sand and gravel that falls into that catch space when you have high velocity water, when it's pouring down, bypasses your drops and just continues on down the line. It'd be one thing if you have somewhat flat, but Thiessen and Jennings have got to be probably 45 degree angles. And when it pours, the velocity going down that pipe next to the road, the gravel that goes into that inlet is just going to continue going down that pipe.
No.
Because I take my Traco down to Webster to get the Jennings one. And I've repeatedly, all you guys got to do is put in like a manhole thing to catch that rock and go in there and back it out in the summertime.
This is a very specific place and problem that I know you've brought up before, Brian. And
I've been at this for 40 years. And so when they talk about, when they go, they show all these things of Happy Valley, these people's houses have been flooding.
Right.
And they're spending their money in Happy Valley. Those homes were not even built when these people were flooding. But they go and they're putting their money where the money is, which is Happy Valley.
I think this fix is on the books. That's what I'm hearing Ron say, is that there is a resolution to it. It's not going to be overnight for sure, because nothing moves fast with this, because of, like you said, identifying the problem to begin with and making sure all that information. And maybe there can be some communication between you three or four and DDT.
You have to understand, I have gone through, I couldn't tell you how many commissioners over the years, how many people of directors of WES. So this is nothing new. This is nothing new.
Okay.
What is new?
For years.
Brian, is that we what is new is our plan, our framework, and the five projects that are in Upper Kellogg Creek in this exact area. And we hear you, and we're not at odds here. You know, we do understand the issues, and are happy to have conversations, especially when we get into planning these projects and designing them with you and people that know the system. But if we can get this plan adopted, and we can get this list, these are our priorities, and we are ready to get started. That's what's changing.
And it sounds like a holistic approach, because it's not just that issue. It everything flows there. So it's coming from somewhere else. So before I move on to William, I need to catch Greg Geist here. He's got his hands up real quick. Wait, William, give me just a second.
Sorry, William. Thank you. And yeah, Brian, we're not at loggerheads here. This development happened back in the late 50s, probably 60s. It's been a problem for a very, very long time, and I get that. Some of the things that we're talking about, though, I'll just throw out a term, fluvial geomorphology. I mean, that system over the last 20, 30, 40 years has gotten completely upside down. And so one thing, putting down, downturns in catch basins is at best a Band-Aid, and it just, we're I feel like we're really have taken a step back. It's the top five priorities or 5 of the top 10 priorities in that basin. We need to really understand what's going on with the stream. There's no easy fix here, and we're completely aligned in that that's a very high priority area. It's just going to take a lot of thought and a lot to actually fix the problem and not transfer the problem somewhere else or exacerbate it somehow.
Right. Okay. So I'm going to move on to William.
I'm not done yet. So basically, so explain it to me. When you put in a new subdivision and you dig like an 18-inch pipe a half a mile through an existing subdivision, take the dry wells offline that are in the road, drain the roads into dry wells, and pump them into this creek that they've known for 40 years can't take it. Why would you do that?
Brian, why would you all I can say is we implement the rules and the regulations that are on the books. You're going to have an opportunity to renew and review those. They're very, very different. There weren't any, frankly, back when this area was developed.
What I'm talking about isn't old.
He's talking about new development.
Yes. And we have rules and requirements related to new development that must be met. Whether they're adequate or not, they were developed 20 years ago. We're currently revising those. I don't know what to tell you. I guess the alternative is a building moratorium, and that has never been on the table.
But you just had a picture there of building dry wells to take road water, putting into dry wells. So why would you take dry wells off of a subdivision, turn them off, take that water from the street, put them into a system that you know can't take it?
Well, because
You guys did that purposely. You didn't have to do that.
Well, I don't know the exact specifics, but we do have an underground injection control permit from DEQ. And there are certain thresholds that if a dry well is too close to groundwater or a whole variety of circumstances, we're obligated to take it offline. Do I agree with that? Absolutely not. And honestly, 14 years ago when I worked at DEQ and they were working on these rules, I said, this is misguided. This water is not causing, groundwater problems. And if we disconnect it from the groundwater, it's only going to cause problems in streams. So do I agree with the concept? Absolutely not. And I didn't when I was the regulator that was supposed to implement these things. But the fact is, those are the rules. I don't agree with it. I don't.
Okay, I need to move on because we're off our schedule now for our next topic. So, William, William, your question is quick. Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Brian.
I won't be back.
Go ahead, William.
After that, I'll make it quick, although it wasn't intended to be quick. Because these are much higher level questions. I wanted to start with some praise for the techniques that were used, both Ron and Leah on this, on the CIP rating and priorities. I think that's very well thought out and I salute you for doing it in that manner. I had two initial questions. One of them is a two part, but the easy one is this plan seems to be focused on Happy Valley, and I'm wondering what's the schedule for dealing with areas beyond Happy Valley. So you don't have to answer these right now. Second one is you talked about retrofits, but my question was about prevention. For example, in new developments, how do we prevent things, negative things from happening? And the second part of that is who's paying for that? What is the responsibility of the property owner? What is the responsibility of the county? What is the responsibility of WES insofar as monies? Speaking of monies, I did want to mention that, when you come back in September, I would certainly hope that Priority CIP and that annual program cost summaries, that you decimal align those numbers, please. I mean, trying to compare $3,000 to $3 million is just crazy when it's all centered. So I would appreciate that being. The other thing, the last comment that I wanted to make, was the cost figures on these, and I'm sure we'll get into this more in September, and certainly as a member of the budget committee, I'm going to be looking at this very hard, is that I want us to be taking into consideration the additional costs that everything is going to be, both interest rates, cost of goods and materials, transportation, and the employment situation, where even if you had all the materials that you needed, if you can't get the employees to actually build the things that we need, we're still in a world of hurt. And I'm working on that at a couple of different levels. As you know, I'm a commissioner on the county's Economic Development Commission, but workforce is a big issue. And I think a lot of those have to be taken into consideration. We're going into, you know, people say we're going into a severe recession. Things are going to be tight. It's going to be expensive for us to do things. And I don't think that we have the right to just pass all of the costs that we would like to have onto our ratepayers. And Greg, I appreciate your comments about how we are very affordable, but I think that there's a great appreciation for us being very affordable, and I would like to stay that way as much as we can. Those are my comments.
Thank you, William. And I had two of those on my list, William. Thank you for addressing that. Yeah, thank you. And I actually have more, but I want to go ahead. Roseanne, you're up next. And then I want to try to move on to our next speaker, please. Go ahead, Roseanne. Roseanne,
sure.
Please.
Yeah, thank you, Diana. Yeah, thanks for, can you hear me?
Barely.
Yeah. Barely.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Maybe take off your video, Roseanne, and just do audio, because I think you're connection.
Can you hear me?
There you go.
Barely? Okay.
Barely.
Let's see here. Better now?
Yes.
Okay, let's try this again. All right. Well, just briefly, thank you for the last two presentations. And I just am curious if you could help connect the dots with me on the rules and standards update, which I think ostensibly should be making its way to the Board of Commissioners this summer, if I'm not mistaken, and this stormwater project, specifically for like the UICs and the outflow control and all that stuff.
Yeah, they're certainly interrelated, Roseanne, as you know, and there are sort of three, as I say, legs of the stool for the bulk of our surface water program. One is our storm system master plan, and that's how we're managing public infrastructure. The other piece is our rules and our design standards, primarily, and that, as you know, that will dictate how, as William brought up, how we avoid future problems by having the adequate infrastructure put in on the private side, a lot of which becomes public, but how that is built. And the third piece is our stormwater management plan, and that's overarching how we manage stormwater, not just from a storm system standpoint. And that's, we do that in compliance with our municipal stormwater permit. We are actively working on all three of those things right now. There are three major initiatives, and we're putting those forward and tying them together. The rules will dictate how the new things get built. So from a flow control standpoint and a water quality treatment standpoint, and the materials and how storm systems are constructed, but hopefully they help reduce our obligations in the future to add water quality treatment capacity and things like that. So that's how they're interrelated, and William made that connection earlier as well. But for the rules, we're actively writing. We didn't really get into a lot of writing until we got the policies nailed down, which we just did in May of this year. So we're writing the rules, and as you said, we're in the process of of engaging the board. That's going to take some time and really is dependent on their understanding, support, and approval of the rules. So we're still shooting for this year. I don't think it's going to happen this summer, but we're still moving the rules project forward as well. It's a lot to handle those three major initiatives for us. It'll completely reset how we manage surface water in our community. We're moving them along as best we can, but I'm certainly behind. I apologize for that.
So just as a follow-up, do you think, Ron, that the CIP for stormwater will end up kind of catching up with the rules and standards project? And then I could see that actually being a silver lining for kind of connecting the dots at the board level, but
yeah.
Just curious.
Yeah, I mean, it'll certainly get us further along the way. And as Greg said, you know, we have many, many decades of development and different standards, but different understandings of how stormwater discharges impact our surface waters over time. And I don't think we can ever, you know, completely get the system caught up to where it needs to be. Right now, we're just addressing our biggest and worst issues. But yeah, I mean, we last updated our stormwater design standards in 2013. They were appropriate for the permit that we had at the time, and we're tightening those a little bit based on new understandings and actually new mandates. But we incrementally get there.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Ron put this on your list, and it might piggybacks or maybe repeats what William said. How much of the detention pond and other things are fixes of it being done wrong the first time, and you know, it development, et cetera. I'm just curious. Are we fixing somebody else's bad job in some cases? Is it totally our responsibility? And you don't have to answer that now because I know I do want to move on, but
sure.
Maybe we can address some of this next time and leave a little more time for discussion. I feel for Brian. I know he's been frustrated for many, many years about the Thiessen Road issue, but I will remind you, we as an advisory committee represent an area, and I know we all have specific issues that we bring to the table, and I'm trying not to discount anything Brian said, but I'm trying to look at it more of as our body is to look at everything from kind of a broader view. So I'm sorry that took up so much time and I didn't interject a little bit sooner, but I want to move on to Josh because he's going to do an operations update for us. And if anyone has any other questions about the stormwater, I would suggest you go ahead and shoot some emails to Ron, and he can maybe gather those, and we can go over them again at the September meeting, if that's okay. Josh, you're up.
Thank you. And good evening. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. As Diana said, my name is Joshua Clark. I'm the current interim operations manager for Water Environment Services. Some background on myself: for the past 4 years, I have been the operations supervisor for the Kellogg Creek Boring and Hoodland Treatment Facilities. As some of you may know, Greg Ierley, formerly in this position, left West for a job in Houston, Texas. And at that time, I was appointed to fill his role as the West Operations Manager. More recently than that, the operations supervisor at our Tri-City facility resigned to take a new role in Washington State. So at the time now, I essentially have three jobs. My success in these combined roles and has been to this date is truly dependent on the assistance of the remaining supervisory team, management staff here included, and our operational team members themselves by stepping up and working as a team together and helping me manage this burden. At this time, Greg has asked me to give you an update on the current challenges we're facing in plant operations, inform you about some projects we have in the works, and review the recent incident that happened at our Kellogg Creek facility, and so I will do that now. These past few months, and I think William had made mention of something similar to this, is that it's been a catalyst to much transition within the operations work group. We've seen senior employees retire, others leave for greener pastures. We've had some difficulty in recruiting new operators, new sanitary and stormwater technicians, and various other support positions around our operations work group. We're definitely seeing the same strains in the labor market that you are reading and hearing about in the news. Many of those who have applied for our jobs are relatively entry level and do not have anywhere near the level of work experience in operations and for the operations staff they are replacing, which in itself then adds workload to our teams that are remaining who are training the new recruits, knowing it will take sometimes upwards of years to educate and build the team up to where it is when we lose those employees through those aforementioned reasons. As it's stated, we are confronted with essentially a generational shift in our workforce. On the positive side, we still have an amazing staff and operations who are knowledgeable, generous, and dedicated to clean water. We are expecting a lot of them, and I want to acknowledge them here tonight. Our staff is exceptional, and they're going above and beyond in so many ways. And as a work group together, we find inspiration in each other every day. There are many things to do in order to support our current employees and bring additional people. We are currently in the process, obviously, of hiring many recruitments, the Tri-City Operations Supervisor position, the Operations Manager position, Greg Early's former spot, and the one I'm currently filling, two operator positions at Tri-Cities, as well as two sanitary and stormwater technicians positions, including the coordinator for that work group. We also need to hire a new safety officer, which will ensure that we have the training protocols and policies in place to keep our people safe. Basically, we're understaffed and at this time scrambling to fill positions. Back to the positive side of things, we've elevated our previous safety position to a higher classification and brought that work in-house within the West organization. That position, safety, risk, and industrial hygiene officer, will work to evaluate our current safety programs, training, and implementation, the practical use of our safety procedures. This is all in an effort to strengthen and improve all aspects of WES's wide range of operational, maintenance, and laboratory staff's work environments. We continue, despite these challenges, with multiple renovation rehabilitation projects at most of our facilities. Three major projects are starting this summer at the Kellogg facility. We are going through a secondary clarifier rehab, an aeration basin rehab and update, and we have the second phase of our influent pump station pump and variable frequency drive replacement kicking off. In addition to that, we have a warranty generator repair. This generator is our dispatchable standby generator. It's part of our PGE DSG program agreement. And so those that repair will be done in partnership with PGE. At our Tri-Cities facility, we are continuing the final work in the digester solids handling and cogeneration project. And at our Hoodland facility, we are updating one of the chemical disinfection delivery systems and adding perimeter fencing to new sections of the property as a neighboring property tree removal has exposed much more of the facility to the public eye. And in that aspect, we are also planning to provide a new vegetation barrier along that property line to further create a barrier buffer that will improve the public vision of the facility and how it impacts the local community. The bottom line from that is that despite our challenges, we are moving forward with projects and our frontline staff are stepping up as they always have and always will. And lastly, I would like to touch on an incident that happened at our Kellogg facility on May 17th. As some of you may be aware, there was an unintentional discharge from that facility without disinfection. The duration of that incident was roughly 50 minutes and amounted to an approximate 350,000 gallons of partially treated effluent to reach the Willamette River. For clarification, this discharge was after that flow had completed both the primary and secondary treatment processes and then was missed by the ultraviolet disinfection step due to an error during the cleaning and maintenance of that equipment. As it is never our intention to make errors of this nature, and we strive at all times to avoid this type of error, and unfortunately, we are still human. We are not perfect and can make mistakes. These mistakes, whatever their nature, severity, or impact, provide us with an opportunity to evaluate, review, and modify. both our processes in completing these tasks, our guidelines, and standard operating procedures we follow, in addition to the operation and programming of our electronic control and monitoring systems. In our root cause analysis and after action meeting, we itemize some important improvements that we have already implemented to further and drastically reduce the potential of an event like this going forward. To us, the public health and safety of our community is paramount. I thank you for your time, and I open the floor for any questions you may have about what I've presented tonight.
Thank you, Josh. Greg?
I just wanted to thank Josh for that, too. You know, not only is Josh filling three jobs under the spotlight right now in front of y'all, I gave him a tough task. And I said, you know, we'd like to talk, and it's nice to talk about the awards that we receive and the good things that we do. And I asked Josh pretty point blank to give a unvarnished, warts and all, view of what's going on in operations, the challenges that we're facing. And so thank you, Josh. I know that was tough.
It's never my intention to sugarcoat things. If there's anything, I'm a face is what you get person. This is, you know, you always have with me.
I know.
All right. Renee?
Thank you, Josh, for the presentation. For the presentation and also for stepping into the role that you're in. We all appreciate that very much. My question for you is, in thinking about the staffing issues that you have going on, it just made me question, in my opinion, WES is a fantastic organization to work for, from everything that I've heard. How do wages for your staff compare to, say, competitors who might be drawing similar sorts of people that you're looking for? How does that compare? Is that an issue, do you think, or not?
It looks like Greg would like to answer this. I'll let him know.
Yeah, and you can chime in, Josh, because you know. Yeah. It's frankly challenging. You know, we're WES. We're also a department of Clackamas County, and when I've looked around at wages, at least, you know, hourly, you're seeing some smaller communities that have similar positions that pay more. Now, there's more to that than the hourly wage. And, you know, that's something that the county, you know, what do they call it? Class and compensation folks look at as we occasionally reevaluate. Like, okay, what's our operator one or two position relative to the market? And we typically compare to Gresham and Clean Water Services, Portland. But just to be candid, that type of analysis has fallen by the wayside a bit across the county over the last couple of years because of a thing called the Equal Pay Analysis. There was an Equal Pay Act that was passed by the Oregon State Legislature. Gosh, it may have been 3 years ago now, that's pretty onerous. It's kind of overwhelmed our class and compensation folks at the county. And I'm sure this may be happening other places as well. But, in my estimation, we simply haven't been doing as many of those, what we call salary studies, as we would have in the past to make sure that we're competitive. So I think we have challenges, frankly, that way right now.
Thank you.
William?
Excuse me, I just want to chime in on this a little bit. And then I would say that regarding salaries, that may be a cause for individuals leaving positions for what they think is a better position. But I don't think that the salaries are the primary motivator for getting new talent, for getting new people to even care about working. I can't talk anymore about this because I'm so passionate about it, but I don't think that money is the prime motivator.
I totally agree. No, I totally agree. Yeah. Yep. It's tough. It's tough out there, and construction companies are paying people $25 an hour to sweep the floor, you know? So it's very tough. All right.
Just one quick thing. When you look at, you know, the workforce in general, salary is you know, essentially, or, you know, total compensation is somewhere like seven out of 10 on people's priority. They want to be in the know and involved. And that's what's important to people, is to feel engaged. And that's, again, why we're doing this workforce work and our mission values, getting people kind of to identify and have some allegiance to who we are and what we do. And I feel like that's the most effective tool in our toolbox right now.
All right. If we're done with that, thank you very much. And we'll, Josh, you got a big job there, big shoes to fill, and you're doing a great job. We appreciate it. We appreciate it. All right. We do have time for Matt to give us another presentation here on asset management.
Awesome. So I get to bookend the evening. I can share that I've been with this organization for quite some time, and I really find a lot of value in just working for a utility that supports clean water. And I know that you all share in that vision and appreciation that we all can benefit from clean water. And so, again, thanks for your time. It's definitely one of the drivers for why I've been with the organization as long as I have. This presentation is intended just to give a high-level overview of kind of what our program is, and I hope that at a future meeting I'll have an opportunity to maybe take a deeper dive into a couple of these things that you may be interested in, but I just wanted to tee up the future a little bit. It's been a while since I've come and talked to the group. So I want to go over just generally what asset management is, what services our program provides, and share a few success stories from, again, our continuous improvements journey. It's kind of the theme and the mantra that I use with my folks. Next slide, please. So I apologize. I'm going to read these just for some background. What is asset management? A process utilities use to make sure that planned maintenance is conducted and capital assets can be repaired, replaced, or upgraded on time, and there's enough money to pay for it. It's a practice of managing the entire portfolio of utility capital assets to minimize the total cost of owning and operating these assets while delivering desired service levels. Really, utility asset management is comprised of all the components you see in the process diagram. It takes commitment and support from the entire organization, but really my team are the champions for a lot of this work in our organization and responsible for many of the components. We are not the ones responsible for the funding piece, but as always, we appreciate your support in that realm. Next slide, please. So we just touched on Performance Clackamas earlier in the evening. This is actually how our purpose statement reads in our Performance Clackamas strategic business plan. The reason I wanted to flag this is, in addition to like tracking assets and asset knowledge and some of the work experience knowledge that Josh is referring to, that we're trying to capture a lot of that in systems. We do a lot of work with software applications, databases, workflows, and ensuring we have good data integrity. And the key term for me from the purpose statement that guides our work every day is the goal of proactive, data-driven decisions that align with our business objectives. Something that I take a lot of pride in, and my team does as well. Next slide, please. So this is just a high-level overview of some of the key services that come out of my group. We're a team of 8, including myself. I'm going to highlight a few of them in this presentation, try to move things along quickly. We'll go over a little bit about asset inventories, our GIS mapping, our databases, fleet management, and then just generally utility management best practices. Next slide, please. So this is just an overarching landscape view of all the systems that we manage, with really the goal being that lower left-hand corner, where we're trying to leverage all the data that we collect in our organization to drive decisions and make sure that they're robust and sound, and we've got a lot of good supporting information behind it. And we've been doing a lot of work on all of these, but just like going around real quick. We've got our geographic information system, our asset management system you'll hear a lot about here. We've got our financial systems that Aaron's a big part of, utility billing, historian that you see there. We capture all kinds of continuous monitoring data from our treatment plants and that. And then we've got our laboratory information management system where all of our analytical data goes. We've, over the last few years, deployed our asset management system on mobile tablets that all of our field crews use. They've got access to GIS. And then we recently deployed a GPS product that's in all of our fleet. But really the goal is leveraging all of that information into reporting that's powerful, that can help people be more efficient and the organization to make sound decisions. For example, we can build reports that blend lab data with sensor data in the treatment plants to help guide operational decisions. In Josh's group, he's got some people that are helping with some efforts with that right now, or blending fleet GPS data with live GIS maps to efficiently respond to customer service requests that are entered by our customer service staff into our asset management system that's in the field crew's hands as quick as possible so we can respond to service needs as efficiently as we possibly can. Next slide, please. So this is just a quick shot of a plant operations dashboard. This one's specifically around operations and maintenance. All of our asset and work management happens from here. We track work orders, maintenance requests, preventive maintenance programs, and all of our asset equipment inventory information, which is critical to a lot of things that you'll hear about. We track approximately 1,630 vertical equipment assets across our various water resource recovery facilities. So there's a lot of information that is captured here, and this is just kind of a quick look at what that looks like. Next slide, please. This is a more detailed look at the asset inventory piece. Obviously, like I mentioned, we've got over 1,600 of these, but this is some of the basic data that we've captured about what we own and operate. And again, many of these records include a detailed asset history, work order history, staff knowledge, photos, O&M manuals, install dates, expected service life information, and condition, which we've been doing a lot of work on collecting that data to inform decisions, which you'll hear a little more about in a minute. Next slide, please. So for our field operations crews, the ones that are out that work on our linear assets all the time, all their asset and work management happens from here. Again, we track work orders, maintenance requests, preventive maintenance programs, condition assessments. With pipeline videos, we have a vehicle dedicated to doing that work. And all the linear asset inventory information we manage in neighborhoods, the public right of way, including now we're starting to track privately owned and operated assets for some of our regulatory requirements. We did it before, but we're putting an even greater emphasis on trying to capture more of that information. And just a few examples of like the level of inventories that we're tracking. And we have, like, as you know, approximately 340 miles of sanitary pipe that's out there, 9,000 sanitary manholes, 14,000 storm inlets, 1,175 stormwater control vegetative facilities. Some of those are ponds. Some of those are biofiltration planters, swales, those kinds of things. But it's a lot of stuff that we're responsible for. So it's really important that we have a database to manage all of our work around those things. Next slide, please. So something that's really cool and fun is that we also have a geographic information mapping system where we map all of this stuff that's on tablets for our field crews. This is 100% integrated with our asset management system. So we track all the things that I've talked about through the maps too. And so they can see where they're at any time, what the asset is. We've got IDs, we track all the history. And so they can do their work through the tablet while they're out in the field. And this is something that we put a lot of work into and we're still continuing to evolve with our crews with this, but this is the future and we've made a ton of progress with it. And just for, I guess, your general information, green is stormwater, red is sanitary. This is generally in the Sunnyside Road area. But there's a lot of assets that we're responsible for. And our field crews do a very noble job of trying to keep up with all the needs out there. Next slide, please. So condition assessments. We've been building our database with the condition of all of our assets. We've accomplished this work with West staff and contractors. All pipe inspections follow like a national standard. And it's actually called the National Association of Sanitary Sewer Company Pipeline Assessment Certification Program. We've got people that are certified in that. And I, as of note, I guess, I think Lynn is still on the call. We also recently completed filling in quite a few condition gaps that we had in our treatment plant data. I partnered with her on the Willamette facility plan, and we had a small scope of work within that broader effort where we filled in all kinds of data gaps that we had. And now we've got baseline condition information on all of our plant assets. And then we continue to gather condition information through our operational process with all the other buckets of things you see here. Next slide, please. This is just an example of one of our condition assessments of a sanitary pipeline where we run a video camera down the line. We look for maintenance issues. We check the physical condition of the pipe. We code the defects, and this data is used to prioritize some of our pipeline renewal replacement projects. And in some instances, the frequency of future inspections and maintenance. And this is a big investment for us. We're doing a pretty solid job at it, but we're looking for opportunities to reduce our contribution with the pipes that we own and maintain for I&I, as well as we're asking our partners to do as well. And we just got a new truck recently that's fully integrated with our asset management system, GIS, so our crews can work as efficiently as possible. Next slide, please. So this is what I'm really excited and passionate about. This dashboard and the next are intended to illustrate where our work is progressing to. At a future meeting, I'd like an opportunity to share more about the specifics behind each of the metrics we're screening our asset data with. I wanted to share we're leveraging data for insights into our large portfolio of assets you've heard about. The data in this dashboard is rolled up because it's insight into condition, performance, risk, and the priority of addressing any potential deficiencies at a glance. This data informs preventive maintenance intervals, inspection frequencies, renewal replacement projects, larger capital investments. And this is just an example of our Intertie 2 pump station that was constructed in 2011. It was intended to divert flows from Kellogg to Tri-City. You might wonder why performance is scored poor for a segment of the assets at this facility. I just wanted to speak to that since it's on here. This is because it will not meet future capacity requirements, which we did plan for in the late 2000s before we built the first phase of this project. And just an update, the capital team right now is currently implementing phase two of this project, and we'll be increasing the capacity there from 10 MGD to 20 MGD. But that's why the performance is shown low for a bucket of the assets in that particular facility. But they won't be stranded investments for the most part. But there's a lot of criteria behind the scenes that lead up to these, which is why I mentioned I'd like to talk more in detail about this in the future. Next slide, please. So this dashboard is just a look at specifically the condition attribute of all of our assets at the Tri-City Water Resource Recovery Facility. The number of the assets is on the left. And then the primary locations for the plant are down below on the bottom. We're currently working on a data update for the digester complex now that the solids project is completed. But just talking with the Capital team today, was talking about this presentation. And it's awesome that there's already like some small and larger projects in the works to address some of the very poor condition things that you see in like the primary basins, primary pump station, the aeration basins. And a few of those, actually the majority, I think were probes, but the primary basins specifically, one of our engineers is working on that literally right now. So I'm really excited about how we're getting to use all the work that we've done with data to start to get visualizations like this to give us insight into our operations and business. So next slide, please. So as a bonus, part of the portfolio of my program is fleet management. We manage fleet for WES. It includes truck and pumps, tankers, hydro cleaners, pump trailers, loaders, backhoes, basically everything that supports our operations. On the left is our newly deployed GPS software that collects data about our fleet. The software improves our operational management and the safety of our staff. We now automatically collect important vehicle data points like mileage, usage, and engine hours that feed our fleet replacement metrics, part of our capital planning, that are based on maintenance costs, age, usage, reliability, condition, and other risk factors. The chart in the middle represents where we're working to optimize the timing of our vehicle replacements. Many of our vehicles in the past were beyond their economic life, that backside of the optimal replacement curve that you see there. As you can see from the statistic on this slide, we've made significant progress here. One of the added benefits of modernizing our fleet that we're recognizing now is the better fuel economy, with fuel costs skyrocketing. And we've seen better fuel economy across all our vehicle types just with updating. And now we're building a solid data set to analyze and optimize the number of vehicles we have in our fleet to better align it with our business needs. And we're looking to be as efficient as possible there. Keep saying that word, but it's a lot of what we do. And we also manage the disposition process for fleet with some assistance from county finance. We're currently implementing a disposition auction plan for all of the resource recovery biosolids fleet. So thank you for your help with that effort. Now that we've contracted that work, we're going to try to get a return on some of those vehicles, and it's a great time for selling vehicles, not a great time for buying vehicles, as you might know. Next slide, please. So as we're coming to a close this evening, thank you so much for letting me share just a little bit at a high level about some of the things that we've all been working on. I wanted to leave you with this. Under Greg's leadership, this is an example of the various systems, initiatives, and just some of the tasks that contribute to our overall continuous improvement efforts and our asset management culture at WES. And yeah, again, thank you for listening. I know it's late, and it's great to share a little bit about what we've been up to, and I look forward to taking a deeper dive into some of this with you in the future.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. And I'm glad we had a little wiggle room in our agenda this evening for that. So, Greg, yes.
Oh, I was just going to say, Matt says under my leadership. I remember giving Matt some vague direction saying, look, we really need to have a robust asset management program. We, in my estimation, before I became director, it was kind of fits and starts. And anyway, I had no idea where Matt was going to take this, and it's amazing. So thank you, Matt.
Very good. Very good. William?
Matt, this might surprise you, but I have a real passion for data and information and even money. And in that regard, in all of this brilliant, brilliant analysis of our assets, I didn't see really anything that talked about, and this is two parts. One is the value of each component of our assets. How much is this worth? How much is that worth? And asking about how it is, how its depreciation is calculated, if we want to know the net worth of a particular area of operations, how much money do we have invested in that? The other thing that I wanted to say is the value of each element of those assets seems as though it ought to be weighted both by the dollar amount that it's worth and also its essential contribution to our overall mission. And how essential is that piece of equipment? I think that that could increase its dollar value. We may be paying a lot of money for something that is nice to have as opposed to something that doesn't cost much, but we couldn't live without it. So I think that there needs to be some sort of analysis in that regard as well. That's all I have to say. Good job. Thank you very much, Matt.
Yeah, thank you, William. And we are working on some of those things with Erin and her team. And I look forward in the future to having some dashboards where we can look at some of the costs associated with things. And we do have some metrics that prioritize really the most important assets and consequences of failure and overall risk mitigation that factor into a risk to cost benefit. I just didn't want to get into any of that, just trying to introduce things now, but I'm with you and look forward to sharing more in the future as we continue to grow with this as well.
Great. Thanks.
Craig D.
Thanks. This was great. I've been looking forward to hearing about this for some time. I mean, for the last 5 years, I've been talking actually around the nation about the need for utilities to do asset management. So it's great that I'm participating in an organization that does. And in fact, just last week, at an interview with the Wall Street Journal, we're talking about utilities. And I talked about this need to do asset management. And for the very purpose of using the limited funds we have so much more efficiently. So Greg and Matt, this is wonderful. I'm glad to have heard it. And now I have an example that I can use on my next interview that I give whenever that might occur. So thank you.
It won't be long, Greg. It won't be long. Anyone else have any questions or comments for Matt? Okay.
Go team.
Go team. That's right. That's right. No, this is great information. Great information we got tonight. Greg, did you have anything else before we sign off tonight? Oh, sorry.
Sorry, no, I just wanted to acknowledge Lynn. Shikoyan is here.
I know. Hi, Lynn.
I wanted to thank Lynn for all of her great work for Wes over the years. And,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us.
Yep, and it's great to see Matt give that presentation. Asset management is part of the Capital Group, and over the years it really grew, and I was glad to help him build what we have for the treatment plants.
Very cool. All right. Well, it sounds like we're going to get a lot more information in the future, but great overviews tonight. And thank you all for your joining us and for your patience. And if we have nothing else, this meeting is adjourned.
Yeah.
Thanks, everyone.
Good night.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Good luck tomorrow, Greg.
Thank you.